Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, Dr. Alyssa Watson, and I'm joined today by a very special guest, Dr. Khursheed Mama. Dr. Mama is a professor of anesthesiology at Colorado State University, and she wrote a very popular article for the September 2020 edition of Clinicians Brief discussing the top five anesthetic management differences between dogs and cats. Hello, Dr. Mama. Thank you for joining us today. If you don't mind, before we jump in, would you tell our audience a little bit about your background and how you ended up at Colorado State?
Sure. I grew up actually in India and always wanted, well, since I can remember, about 9 years old, wanted to be a veterinarian. Thought I would be an equine veterinarian. But during my last year in vet school, I realized I really enjoyed small animals as well. I did go on to do an equine internship. It was equine and food animal. And then during that time, I think it cemented my desire to do something a little different and enjoy both the small and large animal side of things. And I chose to do anesthesia and worked at Davis for 3 years after my residency. And then I've been at Colorado State since 1996.
Wow, that's wonderful. I had done quite a bit of equine work and thought that's what I wanted to do as well, and ended up in primarily small animal practice after about 5 or 6 years out. So sometimes that happens to us.
Does indeed. I always tell students that.
So back when I was in school at Iowa State, I went to Iowa State University. I had a professor that she used to say, cats are not small dogs. So she said it so often, she even included it as a question on our final exam. It was a true false question at the end of the test. And I think it was worth like a half a point. And at the time I thought it was kind of silly, but I still remember it 20 years later. So I guess she made her point. I feel like that is the main takeaway from your article as well. There's really important differences between cats and dogs beyond just size. And so do you feel like, just as a general rule, one species has an increased risk of anesthetic complications versus the other?
I would say per se, no, but there are things that maybe impact broadly that cats have a little bit higher anesthetic risk. And I say broadly because there are clearly areas where the dog has higher risk. If you take health equivalently, you know, brachycephalic dogs have a higher risk under anesthesia. But cats, as far as their size, they make it a little bit more challenging. Their temperament makes it a little bit more challenging. The equipment doesn't always work as well on cats, even if you account for size. So there are some things beyond size, their response to drugs, that make them perhaps a little bit higher risk. More than that, I think cats hide things for longer. So we may see a sicker population of cats when we anesthetize them compared to dogs. We don't often see cats for routine things besides spays and neuters, but we don't see TPLOs in cats, for example, what we do in dogs. And so we don't see them for that, but then they ingested a foreign body and the owner doesn't recognize it for a little while because they hide or they don't show signs. So I think when we get them, they may be a bit sicker and we don't do as many. So I think that increases their risk a little bit. But per se, I wouldn't say cats are at a higher risk than dogs if you account for all the things about them.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. So kind of the population of cats that we're getting in for some of these surgeries might, you know, affect their anesthetic risk more than just the species.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Is there a particular phase of anesthesia, like the pre-anesthetic versus the induction versus the maintenance or recovery, that's considered the most dangerous, like for either species? Does that differ between species for you?
Yeah, good question. I feel like for all species, induction is the time my concern is probably the highest. It's often a time when we're giving drugs to change them from awake to asleep. And those drugs have effects on various body systems, and we're not always monitoring them extensively at that period. So I feel like that is the period when most animals are at the highest risk. But then you take the other side of it and again go back to a brachycephalic or maybe a really ill animal where you're starting to pull off the monitoring equipment, you're not as much being cautious about ventilation or oxygenation. And those animals in the recovery phase, then if they're not monitored, can also have risk. And again, go back to the brachycephalic as the highest risk in that. And of course, everybody monitors them, cat or dog. But that could be the second phase. I think once they're induced, intubated, monitored, you can usually pick up things quickly enough to intervene and make better if they need that. So I feel like induction's probably the area where I am the most concerned about them.
And to combat that, just very close monitoring, you know, watching them. Do you suggest pre-oxygenating a lot of these patients, especially the brachycephalics?
Yeah, you know, I live up at altitude and we pre-oxygenate everything because of that. But even at sea level, I would suggest pre-oxygenating anything where your high-risk brachycephalics fall into that for oxygenation. Mm-hmm. But if you had a dog with chest trauma or a cat with a pyothorax, all of those, I'd say, equivalently should get pre-oxygenated. Not all animals like it. And so that's something that you have to work around. And sometimes we'll give a very little bit of drug just to make them more amenable to having usually a loose-fitting face mask over their nose and mouth so that they can get a higher oxygen flow for a little bit.
Sure, kind of balance out, you know, the benefit of getting the oxygen from the stress of putting something over their face.
Yeah, for those who don't like it or aren't sedate enough with their pre-meds.
So if you had to pick like the most critical difference between these two species, one that you would want your students to remember 20 years later, what would that be for you?
Honestly, I don't know. I feel like all of this plays into it. I don't know that it's the most critical thing, but I think recognizing that cats don't respond the same way dogs do, whether it's to some of the medications we use or under anesthesia, they seem far more sympathetically driven. And so when you don't stimulate them, they lay there with low blood pressures and they may even move a limb. And then when you do something, the blood pressure skyrockets and people get really anxious on both ends. And I think learning that and learning to tolerate some of that and recognizing if they're responsive, it's okay. I think that's different from dogs. I'm not sure it's the most critical difference, but I think that's different.
Well, that's why you had five of them, right? There's five top. So in my experience, cats, you know, you were talking about, you know, their response to you. They seem, for me anyway, more so than dogs, to have this kind of timer, you know, and you hit that mark and that cat is done. We're not dealing, you know, that cat has had it. We're not going to be able to touch that cat again. So do you have some tips and tricks for decreasing pre-anesthetic anxiety in cats, recognizing that, decreasing anxiety, facilitating the handling of these cats before surgery?
Yeah, something that's come up probably in the last few years, which we didn't do before that, which has made quite a significant impact, is to have owners give them tranquilizers or sedative medications at home when they're in a calmer environment where they're more receptive to the meds. And what's been good in the past few years is there's a couple of drugs that have fairly good efficacy at that and are quite safe, so that you do feel comfortable sending an owner home with them and asking them to give it. And they can be given orally. So gabapentin, probably we look for its side effect, which is sedation in these cats. And it seems you can give it even over a little food, which you don't want to use a lot before anesthesia. But if they'll take it, it seems to be palatable. And so that can help. Some people use trazodone and there are other drugs, but I think gabapentin seems to have done the most. Now, if that's not possible, I think bringing them in to an exam room where it's not previously had dogs, there's no barking dogs nearby, having them be in their carrier or secure spot, and then quickly and efficiently taking them and managing them, sedating them, if that's what we were going to do, examining them, of course, first, if we hadn't done that, I think is helpful with them. Even here, we don't do a very good job separating dogs from cats. We do better now than we used to do. And, you know, ICU and other areas have separate rooms for cats, but there are still overlapping areas. And so I think trying to minimize that is also helpful.
That's a great tip too. So trying to keep them separated from the dogs and the other stresses. Do you ever use like pheromone products or anything like that?
Yeah, we do actually. We have Feelyway and we have one of our anesthesiologists is a real cat person and he spritzes it on himself and every time he goes to handle a cat. And sometimes we'll spritz their blanket or their cage or kennel with it as well. So definitely it is something we have used here.
Some people are just kitty whisperers. So so when you're doing this, so specifically, you know, a lot of gabapentin, because I've started using a lot of that as well. If I'm lucky enough to, you know, have examined the cat prior to surgery, sometimes, you know, especially in general practice, the day of spay or neuter might be the first time we see that cat, you know. So, but if I'm lucky enough to send something home the night before and the owners have given GABA or trazodone or one of these things at home, does that significantly then alter, you know, your anesthetic protocol? Are there drugs we need to stay away from? Or, you know, how does that look like once they're then presented to the clinic?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I do look at them as individuals. So if I see them quite sedate, I might minimize the dose of a sedative. So say I was going to use dexmedetomidine and I was going to use 10 micrograms per kilo just to make that up, but I might reduce it to 7 or 5, right? So if they look sedate with the gabapentin, but in general, I don't change it very much. We don't use really hefty doses here anyway, so we tend not to. But if I was using really heavy dosing, I might back it off a little bit. We haven't noticed a big difference. What we do notice is they're calmer, they're easier to work with, they're easier to give the drug to. And so their response is usually more effective. They're better for us, as it were, and I think hopefully better for them as well. But not a lot, and that's probably related to the doses we use.
Okay, that's great. Well, that's exactly what we want. We want them to be calmer in the clinic, and that can make the whole anesthetic process go smoother. So cats, you know, the other thing about cats, oftentimes, I think it's a little harder to gauge pain in cats. And as a clinician, it may not be true, but it feels like we might have fewer options for post-operative analgesia in cats. So do you think that's true? Do you think that we have fewer options, or do you think that clinicians aren't using the options that we have, you know, local anesthetics, NSAIDs in cats? You know, those are things where people have a lot of differing opinion, I find.
Yeah. So first, I think cats are harder to assess. They, again, tend to hide their pain. And I remember when Giuliana Brondani was doing a study looking at spay and neuter animals and assessing pain in cats, that I actually had to learn some of the behaviors because I would not have picked them up. And she had videos and she trained the trainer, as it were, to look for these things. So that was really interesting to me, that she had picked up some subtle signs of pain that perhaps others would not have. So I think that's true. As far as management of pain, except for intravenous lidocaine, which we tend not to use in cats because of the side effects, I really don't think we're that as limited as we think, right? We can use opioids in them. We can use alpha 2 agonists in them. We can use ketamine in them. We can use epidurals and regional blocks with local anesthetics. We can use Nocita in them now, which is the long-acting liposomal bupivacaine. And the NSAIDs, as you mentioned, while they're not licensed for long-term use, I think perioperative use, providing their renal function's okay and they don't have the typical considerations, liver disease, renal disease, or GI disease, I think one can use them. And so, at least for perioperative pain. And so I think we do have options. We may not have long-term options because of certain things, but in the short term, I think we do have options to manage their pain. And the regional techniques offer a huge benefit in cats and dogs. So I think that's something that everybody should consider.
Yeah, increase the use of a lot of those local anesthetics and things like that. And I think if we, you know, manage that pain in the immediate perioperative period and they don't get a lot of wind up, you know, perhaps we're not going to need a lot of long-term follow-up, depending on what they were in for.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Clinician's Brief diagnostic algorithms are step-by-step diagnostic tools to jog your memory and keep you organized. Get the guidance you need to work up a case with straightforward guidelines for testing and case management. To purchase your copy, visit cliniciansbrief.com/algorithms. So one part of your article was talking a bit about the difference in anesthetic equipment and equipment that's available, you know, for the pets when they're anesthetized, as well as monitoring. And I just had some questions about the non-rebreathing circuits. So is it really critical that we need to have a non-rebreathing circuit when we're anesthetizing kittens or very small cats?
I think you could talk to different people and get different answers. If you were doing something really short, perhaps a circle system is okay. So I think the answer is it depends, as many things do. It depends perhaps on length of procedure. It depends on what you're doing. It depends on the ability of the cat to breathe or ventilate, the drugs you use, and whether you have supportive equipment if you need it. So if we use a pediatric circle in cats, we recognize that the work of breathing, both due to lifting the valves and just there's a lot of space in that circuit compared to their tidal volume. So it takes quite a bit to move gas around that circuit. And the work of breathing for them results in eventual fatigue. So if we know we're going to use a circle system, we would also have a ventilator ready for that size animal. And we have that luxury, so we can do that. If you don't have a ventilator, I think a non-rebreathing circuit offers a way to cause less work of breathing for the animal. But there are some downsides. They get colder, for sure. Monitoring CO2 is not as accurate. There are some other things to consider. So I think for us, we use both circuits, but if we had small kittens, I would still use a non-rebreathing circuit.
So you still prefer to use that if it's available. Sometimes, you know, when things are not available, do you have any recommendations on other ways, like to decrease that dead space, prevent fatigue? Obviously, you said they can get cold, so, you know, warming is really important.
Yeah, if you don't have a ventilator and you have to use a circle, I would say keep the flow rate a little bit higher. It may or may not make a much of a difference depending on the amount of dead space you have. And remember, the dead space in a circle is just at the Y piece if the valves are intact and the endotracheal tube. But that could be enough in a cat and your capnograph adapter if it sits between the ET tube and the Y piece. So those things can help a little bit from them rebreathing some CO2 in the circle, even really supporting their breathing. So if you notice the fatiguing, maybe give them a couple breaths every few minutes, see if that helps. To do it well, you actually have to do it consistently. So one breath every minute doesn't really help them, but it's something maybe you can do. Keeping them warm on both circuits, you can put warm water bags over the circuits, etc. That's always in all addition to all the other things that we do to keep them warm. So I think over the long haul, they will fatigue, especially the little kittens on a circle system.
And then there are some anesthetic complications that seem to be, you know, more frequent or unique to cats. One of them being, and I've never had this happen, and I'm going to knock on some wood right away, but I've always been really worried about a tracheal tear because they are so delicate. So I was wondering what your opinion on for really short procedures like a cat neuter, which takes me 5 minutes. Do you think it's appropriate to skip intubation and just provide O2 with a mask? What are your opinions?
Yeah, I think we do a spay-neuter program, and for the most part, while we have a tube available and laryngoscope available, we will do neuters without intubation, unless the student wants to practice, for example. But we'll often do that. But we don't necessarily do it because we're worried about a tracheal tear. I think tracheal tears can occur, and I think it's very tube dependent and how you manage the tube dependent. We have had one here that I can think of, and it was because of an inadvertent error. But as a general rule, we don't, thank goodness, don't see very many of them. And we do things to help mitigate it, right? We try to inflate our cuffs carefully. We try to disconnect the patient from the breathing circuit every time we move them so that there isn't that sort of spiraling of the tube or et cetera occurring. So I think those things are important. But to answer the specific question, I think it's okay. I think the caution has to be things like if you gave them ketamine and they're drooling or salivating, is that likely to plug the airway? Can they protect their airway? Do they still have a bit of a gag or swallow reflex? So I think if you pay attention to those things, then I think it's okay for the short term to just have them on a mask with oxygen and not necessarily intubate them. But if you're ever in doubt and you can open their mouth and put a tube in, I think I would open their mouth and put a tube in.
Tube in if you need to. Absolutely have it ready and right there if you need it. If they were to get a tear, how quickly do those signs occur? Like, what do we typically see? Is it after they've recovered that we notice?
It can be either. Sometimes you'll notice crepitus around the neck or skin in that area where the leak is. So if the tear is in the trachea that's in the neck, then you'll notice some crepitus. And if they've been intubated and you had the tear happen early, you'll see it, you'll notice it. If it's more mediastinal, that can be a little bit harder, and you may not notice it till the cat's dyspneic, which cats hide very well. So that can be a bit of a challenge. If we ever have an unfortunate event, like a pop-off valve gets left closed or, something of that nature, in addition to looking for a pneumothorax, I would look for a tracheal tear in a cat. So, an x-ray to rule that in or out would be one way to do it. If you get one, it seems the best way to manage it is really to keep them quiet, keep them in oxygen, maybe wrap the area if it's in the neck, to hopefully keep some pressure on it and prevent the leak while it's healing, and just keeping them calm, which with a cat is easier said than done sometimes. In the rare case, because we do get some referred in as well, you might have to go and repair, but that's less common.
Okay. So usually, hopefully, just calm, time, oxygen.
Time.
Yeah.
Supportive care, keeping them calm. Yeah.
So another potential complication with kitties is the potential for postoperative cortical blindness. And my understanding is this is best avoided by not using mouth gags in cats. Can you explain a little bit about that, how this occurs and why we think it happens in kitties?
Yeah, there seems to be vascular compression when the spring-loaded mouth gags are used, which the mouth opens really wide and then you position the head in various ways because of what you're trying to do. It's usually dentals. And so there's some vascular compression that then results in cortical hypoxia. And so you get cortical blindness. And again, it's something we thankfully haven't seen very much of, but it's clearly reported in the literature. Because of that, now people use different mouth gags. They usually do a syringe and cut off and then and place it between the teeth. So it's a fixed opening and or don't use them. But for things like endoscopy, where they're worried about the endoscope, we will use mouth gags. We just don't use the spring-loaded ones anymore.
That's a good...
Yeah,
that's a great tip. So it is okay to open the mouth and prop the mouth open carefully, just not that continuous pressure.
Yeah, and as wide as the spring-loaded ones allow mm-hmm. them to go, mm-hmm. perhaps. So that's something one can do, I think.
If you had a case like that, is there a chance that the blindness is reversible?
Yeah, it's a good question. We have seen some kittens from blindness from other things, because I say we don't see a lot of this particular related blindness, but we think maybe they got hypoxic or for other reasons have had some reversal. When I was a resident, we saw this, and I think some of them did show some signs of improvement within the first few days. So where okay. they, you know, couldn't identify their food bowl or et cetera, they started to be able to localize it and develop the menace back and et cetera. So I think there is some recovery, but my guess is it depends on how long and how bad.
Yeah. So anything that we could do to help, or we just wait?
Yeah, good question. Again, not a lot of work that I know of in that area. If you had hypoxic insult in other tissues, you know, we do things like potentially mannitol for free radicals and trying to protect. Some people do steroids for certain things like that. But ideally, those things are given before the event. So I think it's worth a try if all else, you know, you're trying. If there's no risk to the animal from doing those therapies, I think it's worth a try. But I don't have a good answer for that.
That's all right. We'll keep looking. No. This has been a really fascinating discussion. I can't thank you enough for sharing your expertise with us today. I could probably sit here and talk to you all day about this stuff. But before we sign off, though, there is a little game that we play at the end of our time. So it's pretty easy. I kind of just ask you a few would you rather questions, and you tell me the first answer that pops into your head. So would you want to play?
I can try to play.
So there's no right or wrong answers. So first off, would you rather anesthetize an alligator or a tiger?
Tiger.
Tiger. Would you rather redo your veterinary medical residency or redo high school?
Residency.
Would you rather practice without dexmedetomidine or without ketamine?
Difficult one. depends on what I'm doing. I probably say dexmedetomidine.
Okay. Would you rather teach without the internet or teach without textbooks?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Either.
Anyway, I mean, they go to the internet, but there's not always good information, and textbooks are often outdated. So I don't know. I like my textbooks, I guess.
Then textbooks it is. Keep the textbooks. All right. And final question. Would you rather have your cat patients or your dog patients be able to speak?
Dogs.
I think so too, right? I feel like the cats would judge me.
I just want to know that they love me.
Well, I think that they would absolutely love you, both species. So, and we loved having you today. This has been really, really fun. Thank you again for joining us.
Happy to. Take care.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us.
You can also listen to our podcast on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clinicians Brief and on Instagram at clinicians.brief, or drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ussery, sound by Randall Stupka, and hosted by me, Dr. Alyssa Watson.